Mr. Watson, Real Six. We were talking about your time with the reinforcement squadron at Bridlington, and you had a couple more stories you'd like to tell us about.
Yeah. Well, I can remember we were at Bridlington in the middle of winter, and it was extremely cold, as I've already mentioned, the East Coast is cold. And our ration of coal was minimum, to say the least of it. So what we used to do, we used to scrounge for timber on the beach. There was some, but there wasn't very much. We started off by taking the treads of the stairs that had been protected by pieces of board, obviously against the hobnailed boots of the soldiery, so that when the properties were handed back to civilians, the stairs wouldn't be too damaged. So each tread had a piece of wood on it. We started off by detaching these pieces of wood one by one and putting it into the fire. We ran out of pieces of wood on the treads. We then started to take out every other baluster up the staircase. Then we ran out of that, so we took out every other baluster again. So what it ended up is that there were handrails from one newel post to the next newel post with no intermediate balusters. Very dangerous if there had been children, but obviously the soldiery never used to fall through them, even though they were drunk at times. It did keep us somewhat warmer, but not that much. Houses in those days were never double glazed or had any insulation on the roof spaces.
Any other stories?
The other story about the letterbox, the pillarbox. I'll tell you a story about the pillarbox. The ordinary letterbox on the corner of the street was knocked over by a backing tank in the horizontal position. I suggested that they towed it to an upright position, which they did by putting a chain around it. They towed it to an upright position. The pillar box ended some foot higher than it had originally been because the black paint around the bottom of the pillar box was fully seen, whereas previously they'd all been red. The red paint was grossly marked by the chain pulling around it, and the footway around the pillar box was, to say the least of it, in a mess. I don't know what the local customers thought about them leaning up to the aperture on the pillar box, but we didn't stop to ask the post office about it.
Now,
what's that? I can't remember a lot else about Bridlington. Scrounging fish from the fishermen, because there were a few fishermen, and obviously the North Sea hadn't had the attention. The fish had probably recovered. And fish were available. We used to scrounge fish from them. One of my friends there had an uncle who came from Grimsby, and he provided us with a box of kippers, which were very handy. We split the box up, and each of us going on leave used to take a few kippers with us.
Now, the next thing then would be the move to Aldershot. Certainly that's where the second fire, four fire went. Did you go at the same time?
Yeah, we moved to Aldershot and we slept in what had originally been cavalry barracks.
Would that be the Warburg barracks?
That's, I can't remember the name of the barracks. They were right on the entrance to the barracks. Was right in the middle of the town. I don't think the name was Warburg. They were definitely originally cavalry barracks because we were sleeping in what had originally been the hay lofts or the oak lofts or the straw lofts. I know not what, but they were above the tiled areas where the horses used to sleep below. Not very comfortable. We didn't have beds. We had, once again, biscuits on the floors, no bunks. And there wasn't much light or ventilation in them because they'd been designed for straw or hay storage. But we weren't there all that long before we went.
Now, were you doing waterproofing of your dingoes did, and yeah. Shermans there?
Yeah, we did waterproofing.
Can you tell us exactly how you do that to both the Sherman and the dingo, if you remember?
Well, I don't know. By then, we'd lost the dingoes. We didn't have dingoes then. The Sherman waterproofing was a very, very, very lengthy process. And we used to take the tanks for testing to an area called Frensham Ponds, F-R-E-N-S-H-A-M Ponds.
Now, tell us first about the waterproofing, if you can, before the testing.
The waterproofing was a very, very complicated subject. And we had many, many instructions. The name Bostick stays in the mind very, very much. Let's start with the bottom of the tank. Every rivet and screw in the bottom of the tank had to be covered with the Bostick to stop water coming up through rivet holes or screw holes. And similarly with the sides of the tank, around the turret of the tank, one had to fix the turret in the straight ahead position, and the whole of the turret had to be waterproofed together with a ribbon of explosive which would, when primed, would blow off the waterproofing immediately so that the tank could be available for action fairly instantaneously once it had landed on the other side. I forget how the waterproofing around the drive shafts was concerned. I don't think there was any, because thinking about it, the oil bearings, the oil seals on the drive shafts would have stop the lead for water. They keep the grease in, they thus must therefore have kept the water out. But practically every joint and every seal had to be waterproofed. It took many, many days to do the job properly. And as I say, once the turret was waterproofed, it couldn't be moved.
Now, how about the testing in Frensham Ponds? Well, how did that... no one's told me about that. What happened there?
Nobody's told me about it. Oh, I'm surprised. What we used to do, we used to go to Frensham Ponds, and we used to... they were fairly pleasant ponds. They had a gravel a foreshore, no mud, and we used to drive down into the ponds up to the level of the turret, to make sure that what we'd done was good. And then we used the back out again.
And did they leak?
Well, there were one or two weeks about which obviously we got the usual rocketing. But generally, the waterproofing was quite successful. The testing, I thought, was a brilliant idea. It's lucky that the ponds were available for such a testing. I don't know that the regiment did it, but the forward delivery squadron certainly did it.
Now, how about anything else you were doing at Aldershot? Because is that where you converted to the honey? Or did you do that earlier?
When I was at Aldershot, I was crew commander of the honey, and I stayed with that honey until we got to the other side of the channel.
Now, tell me about the honey then. First, what its characteristics were, what exactly it was like, and then what the crew did. It was a tank, wasn't it?
It was an armoured car. It was what I'd call a mini tank. It was, I don't know the exact weight. I would think the honey didn't weigh more than 10 tonnes. It had an automatic gearbox, in other words, completely self-changing. A reasonably powerful engine. It was very light, very fast, but the armament was more or less a pea shooter. And if I remember rightly, it only had a 3-man crew. Gunner, crew commander, radio operator, and driver. was completely American. All of the equipment on it was American except for the 19 set. All the armament was American.
Now, you say three-man crew, so gunner, radio operator, was it, which was the commander?
No.
Sorry.
Gunner, driver, and radio operator crew commander.
Right, so for, sorry.
A dual purpose.
And so your job as usual as crew commander was just tell them where to go. What to.
I could drive tanks, but I very, very seldom do them because having been trained as an operator and and excelling at operating because I knew the theory and the Morse code and the rest of it, I was always in that sphere used as an operator.
Now, what did you think of the honey? I mean,
I thought the honey was probably very, very suitable for what it was designed for. High-speed reconnaissance, but not for much else. I wouldn't have used the honey in an offensive role. It was purely a high-speed reconnaissance vehicle, nothing else.
And do you remember the names of the crew you were with, or did they change?
I mean, no, I can't remember the names of the crew I was with. They changed from time to time. I had, being in a reinforcement unit, one had to be adaptable the whole time. And whilst I can remember the names of many of the people with whom I was for 18 months, 2 years, I can't remember the names of the crew on this particular honey. In fact, I think that when I went over with the honey, we did not go over with a full crew.
Was there any particular friends you had in the unit that you remember?
Yes. I had two firm friends. One was called Alistair McKenzie, who came from Rubber Glen in the suburbs of Glasgow. Another one was Alf Wedderburn, who came from Blythe in Northumberland. I also had a friend called Skelton, after the war, used to send my children books every year. He was employed by one of the printing firms up in London. But the unit I was in, the ages varied between 1920 up to nearly 40. And a lot of these people were in the older age group and their ways were obviously set. And they didn't mix as easily as some of the younger ones did. I also knew several other of the unit by name. Many of them were subsequently killed, but none of them would I describe as firm friends.
Now, how did you get on at Aldershot? It's quite a regiment, it's an army town, isn't it? Did you find it restricting or...?
Well, I suppose not being a drinker, I was probably more restricted than a lot of my friends who would go and drink and go to visit pubs. I mean, there was no point in visiting a pub. Incidentally, as well as not being a drinker, I was a non-smoker, which was fairly unique in that time. I think in the 30th or so in this reinforcement unit, I think it was only myself and one other chap who did not smoke. One or two others didn't drink.
Did they pull your leg a bit about it?
They used to pull my leg about smoking. I said, well, I'm richer than you are, which was obviously the case. Having been taught a lesson from my father about smoking, it would have made me physically sick if somebody had forced me to smoke. I can't remember a lot about Aldershot. I didn't go into the town a lot. It didn't impress me as a very pleasant place. It was not so bad when we went out to places like French and Ponds and got away from the town itself. But the town itself never impressed me.
Anything else about your time there? You weren't there. I think you got there about
the
March.
The other thing was I had my revolver stolen.
What happened about that?
Well, the revolver was laid on the biscuits with the rest of my kit, and when I came for it, it was stolen. I had a call to the inquiry, and I was found guilty of negligence, and my pay was stopped for about £3, I think, the cost of the revolver, over a period of several weeks. I didn't take kindly to that because there were no security measures. I couldn't do other than lay the revolver on the bed. There was no lock-ups provided, so I thought that was a bit unfair, but many aspects of the army were unfair. I don't bear anybody a grudge about it, though.
What happened with... As D-Day approached, because were you there still at the barracks when D-Day happened, or had you moved off?
No, we moved down in a large convoy, and we were actually outside the Solent for several days before D-Day.
Whereabouts?
I can't remember. It was an enclosed camp. I think it was a large country house and we were in the estate. I cannot for the life of me remember. I think we were in Nissen huts, but we knew D-Day was approaching by the huge numbers of aeroplanes that were going over in the early morning. Obviously, without it being announced on the radio, we knew that D-Day had happened.
And what happened next, then?
Well, what happened next, I think about two or three days after D-Day, we were put with these honey tanks on a landing craft tank, which is a fairly small vessel. In other words, one could lean over the side of the vessel and touch the water. Probably about seven of these honey tanks on this landing craft tank. The weather then worsened, and we were unable to go across the channel because, being a small vessel, we would have been readily swamped. So we were anchored in the Solent for, I think, about 4 or 5 days to a week. I'm not sure about that. I know we used to go swimming over the side until some idiots got carried away in the current and landed up on an adjacent landing craft tank, and thereafter swimming was forbidden.
What was it like, cramped on all of those?
Well, there was obviously no room. There were no sleeping quarters. One curled up as best one could on the deck, or one couldn't curl up in the tank very well, and the rations were negligible. One had the usual biscuits and stuff, a cup of tea now and again, but the conditions were fairly unpleasant. But the weather, although it was apparently stormy in the channel, the weather wasn't too bad. It was reasonably warm, and the time passed fairly quickly anyway.
And what about the actual crossing? Do you know what date you went?
I don't know what date I went. Probably about D plus 10, along probably with the rest of the region, but I don't know.
They went about the 16th, yeah, so...
Yeah, about D plus 10.
And anything about the crossing?
No, it was very, very smooth. We landed, being a landing craft tank, we landed fairly close inshore. And all of the waterproofing was used.
Where did you land? Which beach or whereabouts?
I don't know which beach we landed. I know it was a nice, pleasant beach. It certainly wasn't at Mulberry Harbour. I saw no harbour. But we landed there well up the beach, and there was an immediate noise of everybody blowing their waterproofing off around the turret, cracking all round. And then we drove inland. I never saw the honey tank was taken from me. I never saw it anymore.
So, what were you put on?
I was stuck in, I suppose, A echelon, because I was carted about in lorries, but I was immediately behind the lines for several days.
Now, A echelon of who? Of the tank land delivery squadron, or of...
No, there was A echelon of the 5th and 4th of Yeoman.
And what was A echelon, if you could just explain?
A echelon is the immediately... A1 echelon is the immediate suppliers of ammunition and fuel for the tanks.
And would be this the first period before the Battle of Epsom?
I was not engaged in any of the battles. I went up to Hill 112.
But that's a little later, isn't it?
During the Epsom. No, that was on Epsom.
But that's what I mean.
The first battle in
but you'd battle. Already been ashore a fair while then, had you?
Well, a few days, yeah.
So you, where was
it? It was early July, wasn't it?
Because they were at Cully.
That's right. I was probably at Cully. I wouldn't remember.
Now, what do you remember of that period before the battle started?
I can remember the first thing that impressed me was a thing called the cattle compound, where all the various cows had been gathered up from the battlefield, and I suppose cows need milking, and somebody in the army had used their common sense and said, well, why let the cows suffer? Why waste that milk anyway? And these cows were in a compound. That's the first thing I saw. And then I noticed when we went up the road some knocked out German tanks. I also noticed, which stuck in my mind more than anything, a Churchill tank, which seemed to be in perfect condition. But when one looked closely, there was an armour-piercing shell stuck in the barrel of this tank, still there, and you couldn't move it because we tried. And obviously the rear of the gun had gone backwards, possibly killed the crew commander and or gunner, I don't know. But there was nobody there but the tank. This Churchill tank was stuck there at the side of the road and looking completely intact. That was that then. When, I don't know when the Epsom or our first action started.
Can you just tell me a bit about it? So you joined A echelon. What exactly were you doing in A echelon yourself?
Nothing. Just being carted about.
So you were just a spare personnel?
Yes, spare personnel.
And so you just get in and out of the lorries?
That's right, yes.
And what was the composition of A echelon at the time?
Well, I don't know much about the composition. It was obviously drivers who acted as loaders as well. In three-ton vehicles, there were three sorts, I think, of three-ton vehicles. There was Bedfords, Fords and Austins. I think we had a mixture of them all. They were all three tonners being the loading. Most of them had two-wheel and four-wheel drive for going across the country. They were camouflaged, so they obviously had no arms or armament apart from personal weapons.
What did you use to camouflage them?
Well, they were camouflaged normally, and then we had camouflage nets as well.
Camouflage paint, and then and nets on top.
Yeah. But they were painted in camouflage colours, the three-tonners.
And but you weren't driving at the time, you
no,
were just being driven
driving.
About. What about the conditions of service during that period? I mean,
we were on pack rations.
Do you mean the compo, or do you?
Yeah, the compo rations. There was some. Was it not A to G? A, B, C, D, D, F, G. Yeah, A to G.
And can you tell us about those boxes? They were boxes, were they? Or
they were. They were in boxes. Now I forget. I've got an idea that pack rations were originally designed for an infantry platoon, and there were. they varied the idea of Ada tree being a different composition of food every day of the week, so that the army never received what they did in the First World War, bully beef every day. And somebody used their common sense and they designed these so each pack contained, I think, enough rations for 7 people. I could be wrong there. And in each pack, yes, it must have been 7 people because there was a box or a tin of 50 cigarettes and 7 rations, and a cigarette ration was 7 a day. So 7 sevens of 49, that would be that. And then there was enough in one of those packs for 7 people. I remember everybody wanted either an E or an F pack because that contained the best mixture of food, which was most popular.
Which was that? What did you like best?
Well, I can't remember everything, but I've got an idea that the puddings were exceptionally good. I've always had a sweet tooth, and I always look forward to the puddings or afters, or if you like, sweet course. But they did vary. Some had stews, some had corned beef. They were different. It was quite a good variety of food, and they were quite nice.
What about cooking? How did you?
Well, we had cooking on the stoves. Incidentally, I was always a dab hand at cooking. I used to like to engage myself in a bit of cooking. I'll come to that later on when we're in Holland, and I nearly lost my life because of my love for cooking. But what we used to do, we used to try to supplement these rations by, particularly in my case, but being the possessor of 7 cigarettes, which I didn't want, I found them extremely useful in bartering with the locals. Either bartering for Calvados, the Normandy spirit, cider, which you could have for 7 cigarettes, about 5 gallons. Not wine so much, or the Camembert cheeses, which were in plentiful supply. So I used to swap my cigarettes for local produce, let's call it local produce. I sometimes used to swap them with my friends as well, or give them to my friends when no local produce was available.
But you didn't drink, so you weren't gaining a lot.
I didn't drink. But I did, I've forgotten something. When we were in Aldershot, I had a tooth extracted, and there was a corporal called Willie Smith, subsequently killed, who said to me, he said, "You know the best thing for a tooth?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you've had this tooth extracted. The best thing to do is swill a drop of whiskey in the open wound." He said, "It'll stop the bleeding, it'll close the gap up." So I took this, I didn't have any whiskey, obviously Willie Smith produced this whiskey in the Scot, and after that, I liked the taste of whiskey, and I was no longer a teetotaler. That was in Aldershot. So by then, I did drink cider, but I didn't like the cider a lot. It was a bit rough. The Calvados I found extremely fiery, and I didn't drink that a lot either. But nevertheless, I did used to swap these cigarettes for various things. And as I say, I used to try to cook on the stoves that were given to everybody. Petrol given, pressure stoves.
Now, what were you doing during the day then?
Not much. Hiding from the Germans. Taking evasive action.
Did you dig slit trenches for yourselves?
Yes, we did try to dig slit trenches, the operative word is. The ground in Normandy is like it is in some parts of Kent. Extremely flinty, extremely chalky, and very, very hard to dig. I'm reasonably good at digging, but to dig a slit trench is now well nigh impossible. We did try to do it, but now and again you get a piece of ground where one could dig a slip trench, but in most cases it just wasn't possible.